is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
For headlines, the UN chief calls for more financial resources from donor countries to avert a looming humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un says the U.S. is the root cause of tensions on the peninsula. And influential Iraqi cleric Muqtada Assad pledges to fight corruption as initial results from Sunday's parliamentary elections show his party as the biggest winner. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for more financial resources from donor countries to avert a looming humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan.
We need to find ways to make the economy breathe again. And this can be done without violating international laws or compromising principles. We must seek ways to create the conditions that would allow Afghan professionals and civil servants to continue working to serve the Afghan population. I urge the world to take action and inject liquidity into the Afghan economy to avoid collapse. I think that
Guterres explained that the Afghan economy is on the verge of collapse as the country's assets have been frozen and development aid to Kabul is on the pause. The UN chief warned that such matters risk the closure of banks and the breakdown of the country's healthcare sector. They called the situation in Afghanistan a very complex problem, criticizing the international community for a slow response to it. Guterres also noted that there is no way to heal the Central Asian country's economy unless women are allowed to work. Political commentator Wilmer Leon says the complex problem the UN chief refers to in Afghanistan started by the United States decades ago.
And it is a very complex problem that primarily was caused by the United States invading the country 41 years ago under the administration of Jimmy Carter. And it's been, I think, eight American presidents that have been engaged in Afghanistan in some form or fashion since 1979. So the United States has to step up in all of this. This is not the time. Children are dying here. People are dying here of malnutrition, of preventable diseases. Now is the time for the United States to step up and do what American presidents come to the podium and talk about doing all the time, protecting democracy. We hear Nancy Pelosi right now is somewhere in, I can't remember exactly where, receiving a humanitarian award, and she's talking about the rights of Afghan women while female Afghans are dying from polio. It doesn't make sense. It's hypocritical.
Welcome back. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un says the United States has, quote, the root cause of instability on the Korean Peninsula. Kim, during a defense exhibition, said there is no basis to believe that Washington is not hostile toward Pyongyang despite its denials. He also accused South Korea of seeking to destroy balance on the peninsula with its military developments. The North Korean leader said his country's weapons programs are in self-defense in the face of hostile U.S. policies and a military buildup in the south. He said, however, that Pyongyang will not start a war in the region. Kim has long accused Washington and Seoul of pursuing a hostile policy. Tensions have escalated since the two neighbors conducted missile tests in recent weeks. Lawrence Davidson, a former lecturer with the Westchester University, says American leaders can hardly make a decision on leaving the Korean Peninsula, as it might prove a political suicide for them.
Now, the Americans have a long history on the peninsula, and that history really flows from an anti-communist kind of crusade that the U.S. entertained after World War II. To a certain extent, that crusade still goes on, even though, you know, the Russians are not called the USSR anymore. But I mean, the Chinese are right across the Yalu River, and so, you know, China is a potential enemy for the U.S. And so, you know, that kind of anti-communism and now just identifying competitors and enemies, that persists. Also, there's a certain amount of face, I guess you would call it, involved in this. I mean, what does Kim want the Americans to do? Pack up and leave. All right, but I mean, that's political suicide for whatever American leader does that.
Iraq's prominent cleric, Muqtada Assad, has vowed to fight corruption after initial results from Sunday's elections showed his political movement has secured the biggest share of seats in parliament.
We won't allow parties to take control of public money and resources. They are for the people. Every corrupt person will be held accountable, whoever they are.
Sadr added that his movement will work to protect and secure the country. His supporters also hit the streets in the capital, Baghdad, to celebrate the victory. The exact number of seats won by the Sadr bloc is not clear, but it is said to be maintaining the most seats, leading in several provinces, including Baghdad. Former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's party is likely to have the next largest win. The country's electoral commission says the results are not immediately available for all provinces. The commission has put the voter turnout at 41%, lower than the last general election held in 2018. Nearly 25 million people were eligible to cast their ballots for the 329-seat legislature. Chinese officials say last week's floods in Shanxi province have killed at least 15 people. The officials say three people are still unaccounted for. They say the flooding triggered by torrential rain disrupted the lives of nearly 2 million residents. Tens of thousands of buildings were destroyed or seriously damaged too. Shanxi province in North China is normally a dry region, but it received 3 months' rain in almost a week. Several other regions across China were also hit by unprecedented rain and flooding this year. One of the worst hit areas was the central province of Henan, where more than 300 people were killed in July. Experts blame the situation on climate change. Police in the U.S. city of Dayton, Ohio, have released footage showing white officers forcibly removing a paraplegic African-American man out of his vehicle and arresting him. Dayton police said they are investigating the incident that took place during a traffic stop. The officers say they were observing a suspected drug house in the area. That is why the man wasn't charged with any drug-related crime. Clifford Owensby has filed a complaint against the police department over the incident. It says no weapons or drugs were found in his vehicle. Owensby has accused the police of racial profiling and brutality, two issues that have sparked outrage across the U.S. in the past few months. Authorities on the Spanish island of La Palma have ordered some 3,000 residents to remain indoors after lava spewing from a volcano destroyed a cement factory. A crisis management official says the order has been issued for people living near the factory until the air quality is analyzed for normal life there. The lava-induced fire at the factory has raised fears of toxic gases and fumes. Around 6,000 people have evacuated from the island since La Cumbre Vieja volcano began erupting on September the 19th. The island, which is home to some 85,000 people, has experienced three volcanic eruptions in a century. Protests have taken place in Bolivia against a law that would allow the government to investigate assets of any citizen without a court order. Protesters filled the streets in main cities, including the capital, La Paz. In some locations, police used tear gas to break up the rallies. Arrests were made, too. The demonstrators accused the government of political persecution and stealing democracy. They also accused President Luis Arce Catacora of stealing people's right to their own property.
We ask President Luis Arce Catacora to annul those laws and not to enact them, because if not, one more enemy of the Bolivian people will have won.
The law is currently under debate in the Bolivian parliament. A presidential spokesman said those protesting the legislation are trying to destabilize the government. Demonstrations in support of the government were also held. Legislators claim the recently published Pandora Papers, which reveal how the rich and famous Dutch tax proved the EU is more interested in supporting wealth rather than social justice. During a debate in the European Parliament, they demanded that swift action is taken to close tax loopholes. Jerome Hughes reports.
Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš is the most high-profile politician in the EU to be exposed by the Pandora Papers leak earlier this month. It was revealed that Babiš, who lost a re-election bid just last Saturday, spent €19 million using tax haven companies to buy a chateau in France. The scandal has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Andrej Babiš behaves again as a hypocrite, as a liar, as a person despising democracy, but this time also as a businessman doing shady transactions.
Hundreds of current and former politicians, celebrities, religious leaders, and drug dealers have used so-called shell companies to hide their wealth and investments.
Madam President, I am livid.
A consortium of journalists from around the world compiled a report containing 12 million leaked documents, dubbed the Pandora Papers.
As countries scramble for millions to fund health and social services, $11 trillion are out of reach offshore.
Most of those avoiding tax are based in the West. EU leaders who talk a lot about values are accused of hypocrisy.
Why is the United States, which is not cooperative, again not mentioned, whereas in the Pandora Papers it's very clear that the United States are becoming a bigger and bigger problem?
Experts warn the issue will never be resolved unless the rich and powerful develop a conscience.
I think that the ultimate question in the end is individual ethics, and living by good example, by those, who actually want to defend the system. And without that, the best monitoring, the best legal framework, the best regulation can't save you.
Legislators say a big problem relates to the amount of money politicians and policymakers can generate for themselves.
Where action could but isn't taken, there's obviously no political will to stop mass tax evasion by the super rich.
Revelations like these are nothing new. Lawmakers say it proves European Commission policies in this area are not working, and therefore it is simply a matter of time before more scandals come to light. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has denounced the Daesh attack on a Shia mosque in Afghanistan, saying the terror group is seeking to plunge the country into civil war. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said the attack in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz shows Daesh is trying to stoke internal tensions. Nasrallah said the U.S. also shares responsibility for the bloodshed, as information suggests it has relocated Daesh terrorists from Iraq to Afghanistan. Elsewhere in his remarks, Nasrallah called on the Lebanese government to make it a priority to resolve the country's energy crisis. He urged the government to seek a U.S. sanction waiver to import Iranian fuel oil and alleviate crippling shortages. Iran's parliament speaker says any agreement on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, must remove U.S. sanctions. Mohammad Baghir Ghalibaf made the call in a meeting with Swiss National Council President Andreas Abi in Tehran. Ghalibaf said the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden persists on its predecessor's sanctions policy against Iran. He noted that Washington must take the first step and fulfill its commitments under the JCPOA if it expects Tehran to do the same. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions against Iran. JCPOA revival talks remain stalled over what Tehran deems as excessive demands from the United States and the European signatories to the deal. Political commentator Tony Gosseling says more powerful forces in the U.S., backed by Israel, are making all efforts to stop the revival of the Iranian nuclear deal.
The Israelis, I'm afraid, are not content to talk about peace because they believe that they can gain more from war. And of course, the main thing which is keeping that war out of the way is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, a very important deal brokered by Biden and many of the other players in Europe, etc., which President Trump tore up. Now, there are very powerful forces, Zionist forces, within Britain and the United States as well as in Israel, that simply doing everything they can to stop that deal being remade. And I'm afraid that's what we're dealing with right now, is a Biden administration that, although they got elected, and he got elected on the idea of putting that deal back together, there is some very powerful financial and military and ideological forces, I would even say maniacs, trying to make sure that deal never happens again. This is what I think most families, most ordinary people around the world looking at this conflict cannot believe, that war is any solution to anything. But I'm afraid there is a tiny minority, both in Britain, the United States, and even in Europe, actually, but mainly, obviously, in Israel, in the right-wing government that we've got now, and we've had for many years, really, since the assassination of Rabin in the 1990s, that sees this as a political solution to actually create conflict. We called it in the 1990s and the 1980s in Europe a strategy of tension, and it's that strategy of tension that the Israeli government is now pursuing in order to try and stop the remaking of the deal.
Well, that's your war news for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
A bomb attack claimed by Daesh terrorist group on a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's northeastern city of Kunduz has martyred more than 50 people and left scores of others injured. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor and blogger with over 10 years of experience. The piece is titled Daesh War on Hazara Shias in Taliban's Afghanistan. The deadly spiral of violence targeting Afghanistan's long-repressed religious and ethnic minority, Hazara Shias, continues unabated. From the notorious Pashtun ruler Abdul Rahman Khan in the late 1880s to the Daesh terrorist group in the 21st century, this vulnerable group has known nothing but violence and death, and everything in between. The juggernaut ruled again recently during Friday, 8th of October, congressional prayers, in the northern city of Kunduz in Afghanistan. A young suicide bomber masquerading as one of the worshippers detonated his explosives during prayers, leaving a trail of death and destruction. The devastating attack followed a strikingly familiar pattern, which has come to define the terrorist group's modus operandi in Afghanistan since 2014, when it first made inroads into the war-ravaged country. More than 100 casualties have been reported from Friday's high-intensity bombing at Guzar-e-Sayyedabad Mosque in Khanabad area of the city of Kunduz, with a predominantly Hazara population. The toll is likely to mount, as many have been admitted to hospitals in a critical condition. Video footage shared on social media showed heartbreaking scenes inside and outside of the mosque, with disfigured bodies scattered throughout the debris. One video showed a distraught mother wailing over the body of her young son. Not much remained of his lifeless body, though. There were other extremely graphic images, too, with body parts hanging from the ceiling inside the mosque and plumes of smoke rising from the burning structure outside. The blood and tears were indistinguishable. Eyewitnesses and survivors described the apocalyptic scenes in the aftermath of the bombing, with ambulances ferrying the dead and people frantically searching for their missing relatives. Muhammad Imran, a local resident and eyewitness, said, "All I could see was blood and body parts and frightened people standing numb, not knowing the fate of their friends and relatives." At least three of his friends were martyred in the bombing, and many are still missing. One eyewitness said his father was critically wounded in the tragic incident, but had no information about some of his friends who went to the mosque on that day. Hardy cried, "It feels like doomsday. Everything seems to be over," adding, "What did we do to deserve this? Why do they keep snatching our loved ones from us?" Zaki Daryabi, chief editor of Kabul-based newspaper Ittilaat, said a woman who lived in the neighborhood for 2 years had 23 people in her immediate family either martyred or injured in the deadly blast. Zaki Daryabi shared pictures of some young victims who had been identified by their families and a video showing people digging mass graves in an open field. Pointing to poor services, he said many people had succumbed to their wounds due to a lack of medicine. Local sources said that hospitals and dispensaries were teeming with patients. The trauma center run by Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders in Kunduz, had treated more than 100 wounded people since many others were brought martyred to the hospital. It's important to recall that on 3rd of October 2015, the U.S. occupation forces had bombed this same hospital, killing at least 42 people, including innocent women and children. Scores of patients were charred to death and many others were badly decapitated in a horrendous war crime that largely went unnoticed. The latest diabolical attack, reminiscent of the October 2015 bomb attack, is among the deadliest terrorist attacks in Afghanistan since the US-led invasion of the country in 2001. And the first since the Taliban announced a caretaker government in Kabul recently. The last time Daesh terrorists mounted an attack was immediately after the Taliban's sweeping takeover of the country and the US-led coalition's hasty and humiliating retreat outside Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport in mid-August, killing over 160 civilians. In recent weeks, there have been intermittent attacks on Taliban militants in eastern Nangarhar province, the Daesh stronghold, and the two groups step up their long-running rivalry in the volatile Afghan-Pakistan region. Experts see Friday, 8th of October bomb attack serving multiple purposes for Daesh Takfiri terrorists to undermine the Taliban's newly established rule and to continue its long-running murderous campaign aimed at ethnically cleansing the minority Hazara Shia community from Afghanistan, which it has long seen as part of the resistance front in Syria and Iraq. In a statement after the attack, the terrorist group said the suicide bomber detonated his explosive vest amid a crowd of Hazara Shia worshippers inside the mosque. The explicit mention of Hazara was striking. The group vowed to continue targeting the vulnerable Hazara Shia community, who constitute roughly 15-20% of Afghanistan's population. In Kunduz, they make up about 6% of the 1 million population. Since Friday, social media have been flooded with evocative messages expressing solidarity with the persecuted Hazara community and warning against Afghanistan becoming another Syria. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on Afghanistan's authorities to punish the perpetrators behind last Friday's terrorist attack, targeting worshippers at a packed mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. Ayatollah Khamenei wrote in a message on Saturday, 9th of October, "The bitter tragic incident involving a blast at a mosque in Khanabad district of Kunduz province, which resulted in the death of a large number of people of faithful worshippers, saddened us." He added, "Authorities in the neighboring and brotherly country of Afghanistan are seriously expected to punish the bloodthirsty perpetrators of this heinous crime and take all the necessary steps to prevent a recurrence of such a tragedy." The leader of the Islamic Revolution also asked God to bestow mercy and the highest heavenly blessings upon the souls of the martyrs of this incident, and prayed for the immediate recovery of all those wounded. Meanwhile, Iran's president, Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi, has voiced his concerns about the persistence of terrorist attacks in neighboring Afghanistan, saying it is no secret that the growth of Daesh terrorist group, which claimed responsibility for the latest atrocity in Afghanistan, was an American job. In a message released on Saturday, 9th of October, President Ebrahim Raisi expressed his condolences to the people of Afghanistan and the entire human society over the martyring and injuring of a large number of innocent Afghans whilst they were praying in a sacred place. President Raisi said, "It is no secret to anyone that the growth of this Takfiri terrorist movement has taken place with the full support of the United States." President Raisi added, "In recent years, the United States has facilitated further activities of Daesh criminal terrorists in Afghanistan and prevented their eradication." Furthermore, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf, also expressed his condolences to the Afghan nation and all those who lost their loved ones in the latest terrorist atrocity, while calling on Afghanistan's new authorities to act decisively against the culprits of this horrendous attack and to prevent the recurrence of such painful atrocities in the future. Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf wrote in his message, "The criminal hand of the foolish terrorists was once again stained with the blood of the oppressed worshippers, in line with the anti-Islam bigotry and Islamophobia." Criticizing those who often claim to champion human rights over their silence in the face of this terrorist attack, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament also said the international community is expected to forthrightly condemn such tragedy, introduce the already infamous sponsors of terrorists, and commit them for trial. Also, Samira Hamidi, a human rights activist, said the Kunduz attack is a reminder that terrorism is at its peak in Afghanistan, warning against ignoring the dangers posed by the Takfiri terrorist group Daesh. Munazza Ebtekar, an Afghan researcher at Oxford University in England, said there are no feelings of sadness or desperation, just anger, asserting that the murderous campaign to kill the Hazara population can and will be stopped by the people of Afghanistan. Pertinently, it is not the first attack on the minority Hazara community in Afghanistan claimed by the Daesh terrorists. The targeted attack have assumed alarming proportions since 2014, when Daesh terrorists made a foray into Afghanistan for their original bases in Syria. The attacks on Ziyarat-e-Sakhi Shrine in western Kabul in 2015, Baghar ul-Ulum Masjid, or the Baghar ul-Ulum Mosque in central Kabul in 2015, the Al-Zahra Mosque and Imam Zaman Mosque in western Kabul in 2017, Hazara Educational Center in 2018 are just some of the examples of ghastly terror attacks perpetrated by the Daesh terrorist group in recent years. More recently, in May of this year, three bombs struck outside a girls' school in western Kabul's Hazara-dominated neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi, leaving at least 68 people martyred. The victims were all young girls with big dreams. The pattern of attack remains the same, but now a different set of players are running the show in Kabul. Will the Taliban, which has its rivalry with the Daesh terrorists, up its game to protect the vulnerable Hazara community, or will we see the repeat of the late 1890s? Time will tell.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
به خاشقچی کیف
In October 2018, the Saudi regime carried out one of the most egregious acts of terrorism in the modern world. As Jamal Khashoggi, a veteran Saudi insider turned mild critic, entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to collect some documents, he was ambushed by over a dozen Saudi agents and subsequently killed in a gruesome manner. The murder of Jamal Khashoggi was unusual and egregious in several respects. The most unusual and damning feature was it occurred inside Saudi diplomatic premises. The Saudis could have killed him anywhere, but the fact that they chose to murder him inside a diplomatic facility sent out disturbing messages to the world.
But it means we are not safe, because a consulate, this is a consulate. People go to consulate to obtain papers, to renew passports, to get certificates of certain things. I mean, if the Saudi consulate can turn into this, then probably other consulates of similar regimes might do it. And if they can do it in a consulate, they'll probably next time contemplate doing it in the streets, in the road.
The Saudi regime was giving out the message that it either believed it could get away with murder or felt it could deal with the fallout.
He feels he is powerful enough to go beyond this crisis. And he's going to impose his own way and style of governance, and he's going to buy himself out of it. And definitely he's empowered by his friends in the White House. That's very important, by the way. The only consistent factor in the Saudi strategic understanding of the world is the White House, the Americans, always. So they take that seriously. So you have Trump, you have Jared Kushner, and you have the friendship between them and the interest, of course, that has been built. In my opinion, he feels empowered as long as these guys are there.
The manner of the killing was remarkable, as Khashoggi was hacked and sawed into pieces, and not a shred of him has been found since.
I want to know who gave the order to kill Jamal, and who else knew. I want to know where is his body. I implore you to take action.
But who was Khashoggi, and why did the Saudis kill and dismember him in such a brutal fashion?
Really, Mr. Jamal Khashoggi was not as he seemed on the media, with his husky voice and the serious character. He in the life he is a funny man, and he wasn't a smoker, but he was preferred to smoke cigar and drink coffee. Or one time he said to me, the Saudis or the authority in Saudi Arabia treat him as if he shot on the member of royal family and fled outside Saudi Arabia.
Jamal Khashoggi had lived his entire adult life, bar the last few months of his life, within the close circles of the Saudi court. Much has been made of his supposed opposition to the Saudi regime in the last year of his life, but the truth is that even in those final months, he was little more than a mild critic of some aspects of Saudi foreign policy, notably the self-defeating war in Yemen.
Jamal was not a dissident or opposition, as people in the media keep describing him. Jamal was a loyal, normal Saudi citizen. He was his main sin is that he was bright, he was a maverick, and he was outspoken. He couldn't hold things back.
Khashoggi opposed the Saudi war on Yemen not because it killed and maimed Yemeni civilians, but because he saw it as a war that Saudi Arabia could not win. Partly of Turkish origin, Jamal Khashoggi was attracted to a variant of the Muslim Brotherhood in his early adult life. His organizational links with the Brotherhood strengthened when he went to Afghanistan on ostensibly journalistic assignments in the 1980s. Khashoggi was of the opinion that aspects of Brotherhood ideology were compatible with the Wahhabi doctrine of the Saudi state, and throughout his life he tried hard, but in vain, to reconcile the Muslim Brotherhood movement with the Saudi regime. Another important aspect to Khashoggi's biography is that he was a lifelong affiliate of the Saudi Foreign Intelligence Service. This affiliation intensified when he effectively became the right-hand man of Prince Turki bin Faisal, the former veteran chief of Saudi Arabia's Foreign Intelligence Agency. Throughout his life, Khashoggi balanced his journalism with his affiliation to Faisal's agency, all the while appearing as a reformer who was able to soften the regime's edges. And herein lies the value of Khashoggi to the Saudi regime. Khashoggi was at the helm of Saudi Arabia for most of his adult life. He worked for flagship newspapers such as Al-Sharq Al-Awsat before being appointed as deputy editor-in-chief of Arab News.
He was appointed as editor-in-chief of Saudi daily Al-Watan in 2003, before being dismissed for espousing ostensibly liberal views. He was reappointed to the same role in 2007 and stayed in the post until 2010. The beginning of Khashoggi's separation from the ruling clique of the Al-Sauds can be traced to the shift in power at the top of the Saudi regime, which began in earnest in January 2015 with the death of King Abdullah. The demise of Abdullah, who was widely viewed in the West as a reformist, and his succession by Salman bin Abdulaziz paved the way for the ascent of a younger and more aggressive leadership. The ascent of the aggressive and monopolistic MBS, who officially became the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia in June 2017, spelled the end of Khashoggi's decades-long dalliance with the Saudi regime. At that time, Khashoggi had already been part exiled in the smaller Persian Gulf states, notably Bahrain, where he tried to launch a satellite news channel in vain. But following MBS's consolidation of power, Khashoggi moved to the United States, a move that infuriated MBS and his inner circle. Jamal Khashoggi's murder stands as arguably the worst and most egregious case of state-sanctioned assassination in modern history. Whilst there are plenty of states who are in the business of murdering their opponents outside their borders, few, if any, have considered killing people inside their diplomatic premises. The assassination was also notable for the scale of its planning and the manpower required to do the job. Up to 15 Saudi operatives were waiting for Khashoggi when he entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October the 2nd, 2018. Independent investigations say the team was led by Major General Ahmad Asiri, a former intelligence chief and an ally of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Asiri was also a pivotal figure in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and was also implicated in anti-Iranian intrigues, including a childish plot by the Lebanese-American businessman George Nader to instigate regime change in Iran. At a planning and operational level, the assassination was reportedly directed by Saud al-Qahtani, an established Saudi insider and media consultant to MBS. Prior to Khashoggi's assassination, Qahtani was widely described as a major influence on MBS's domestic and foreign policies. Following Khashoggi's murder, al-Qahtani disappeared from public view, and there are credible reports that he too has been murdered by the Saudi regime. From the outset, the Saudi regime not only denied culpability in Khashoggi's murder, but it denied that the former insider had been killed in the first place. This macabre pretense was kept up until Turkish authorities provided incontrovertible proof that Khashoggi had been killed. And once Saudi culpability had been established, the regime's strategy revolved around damage control, and specifically to shield the top of the Saudi leadership from any blame. The central focus of Saudi media and public relations efforts rested on the lie that the top man, Mohammed bin Salman, had not only not ordered the murder, but that in fact he was unaware of it. Of course, nobody believed this lie, and the Saudis have had to give up the pretense.
After weeks of lies, false statements, obfuscations, Saudi Arabia finally admitted that the journalist Jamal Khashoggi died a violent death in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. However, their explanation of how he died, claiming he got into a fight, doesn't make any sense. In addition, they demoted several intelligence officials and advisors, seeming to put the blame on the intelligence apparatus. And it seems as though it's an attempt to insulate Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from further scrutiny or from further inquiry on this matter. We think that the international community needs to get to the bottom of what happened, who called who ordered the hit, where the chain of responsibility lies.
International criticism to Jamal Khashoggi's gruesome murder was muted from the outset. The Turks, who had been monitoring the Saudi consulate in Istanbul round the clock, appeared to drag their feet by selectively feeding damning evidence to the international media. The Turkish approach appeared to suggest a well-thought-out strategy to extract concessions from the Saudis, as opposed to establishing the Saudis' guilt in bringing the perpetrators and those who ordered the killing to account. The Western reaction to Khashoggi's murder was equally muted and ultimately hypocritical. The Washington Post reported on October 10 that U.S. intelligence services had intercepted communications which indicated that the Saudis intended to kidnap Khashoggi from his home in Virginia. Most damning of all, the intercepted communications indicated that the kidnapping was ordered by none other than the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Following the murder, the U.S. did not downgrade its relations with the Saudi regime, despite uproar in the U.S. Congress.
I have zero question in my mind that the Crown Prince, MBS, ordered the killing, monitored the killing, knew exactly what was happening, planned it in advance. If he was in front of a jury, he would be convicted in 30 minutes, guilty. The question is, what do we do about that? So far, it's unfortunate, but I think they feel like this is something that's come and passed because the administration has not spoken to this in a way that has spoken to it in a manner that really gives them immunity. And so what the message is to him and those around him is that you can go around killing journalists. Countries like the United States can know beyond a shadow of a doubt that you killed a journalist. And by the way, they, as you know, renditioned other people and tortured other people that have been their dissidents.
The attitude of the other key Western allies, notably the United Kingdom, was broadly similar to that of the Trump administration. The British government condemned Khashoggi's murder, but stopped well short of attributing blame to the Saudi leadership. In fact, the British government continued to conduct business as usual with the Saudis by supplying the regime with arms and expertise to prosecute the war on Yemen.
Every human rights norm at home and abroad. Its government believes that it can kill with impunity journalists or civil rights campaigners, Yemenis or Bahrainis. It funds extremism around the world. But the UK has supplied them with over £4.5 billion worth of deadly weapons.
For Britain and America, Saudi Arabia is a key ally, and it seems no act, however gruesome and deplorable, runs the risk of undermining this alliance.
With all of that being said, though, we have $450 billion, $110 billion of which is a military order, but this is equipment and various things ordered from Saudi Arabia. $450 billion, I think it's over a million jobs. That's not helpful for us to cancel an order like that. That hurts us far more than it hurts them.
One of the most important aspects of Jamal Khashoggi's murder is that it underscored, in graphic and gruesome fashion, the true nature of the Saudi regime. The regime cannot tolerate even the mildest form of criticism, even from erstwhile allies and insiders. MBS was hoping to cultivate a climate of fear by killing Khashoggi and to send out a message that no one is safe, no matter where they live.
This recent killing of Jamal Khashoggi is part of a broader crackdown on dissent that is taking place in the kingdom. And we worry that if the Saudi Arabian authorities get away with this killing of Jamal, then this will send a chilling effect. And obviously, there will be negative consequences to those in Saudi Arabia who dare to speak out.
Hands off Yemen!
Justice for Jamal!
Whilst this strategy may bear fruit in the short term, by exerting a chilling effect on dissidents and opponents of the Saudi regime, longer term, it is likely to have the opposite effect.
Can't hear you! Stop arming Saudi!
Justice for Jamal!
Well, we've decided to call a protest because we believe that the behaviour of the Saudi regime is unacceptable and extremely dangerous. Clearly, the killing of Jamal Khashoggi was an outrage, and a provocation, actually, which has caused shockwaves around the world. But this takes place against the background of the war on Yemen, which is being led by the Saudi regime, which is causing massive destruction and misery as it is.
Khashoggi's murder by Mohammed Bonsah Salman is likely to sabotage the morale of Saudi friends, allies, and agents across the globe by making them fear for their own futures.
No democratically elected leader will feel comfortable anymore to have a photo opportunity with Mohammed bin Salman smiling, because it's going to be a heavy burden on him. And we need to keep that alive. We need to keep that pressure, not to allow politicians to do business as usual with the Saudis because of any justification, including, of course, an economic interest or the pretext of keeping the links with Mohammed bin Salman in order to try to push him here and there. These are pretexts that do not work.
Jamal Khashoggi was no saint. He wasn't even a proper journalist. Most of his journalism was a byproduct of his long-standing association with the Saudi Foreign Intelligence Service. There is even suggestion that he had kept up contacts with parts of the Saudi regime right up to his death. It should also not be forgotten that for all of his adult life, barring the last few months, he was an advocate of Saudi foreign policy, including the belligerent and sectarian attitude towards Iran. That said, he didn't deserve that gruesome fate. Part of Khashoggi's legacy is that it has fully exposed Western hypocrisy and double standards on issues such as human rights, the rule of law, and inviolability of national sovereignty.
It was not only my beloved Jamal who was murdered that day, but also democracy, human rights, and freedoms. The failure to punish Jamal's murderers affects us all. Mr. Chair, the truth always wins. History will take note of those who stood with truth and those who did not. Please take action.
Saudi Arabia violated all these norms and values by carrying out a brutal murder in the heart of Turkey's most iconic city. Another major legacy is the demolition of the carefully crafted myth around MBS and his inner circle. When MBS first emerged on the scene in early 2015, he was presented as a reformer and enlightened leader by the Western press.
Mohammed bin Salman's image as a potential reformer has gone down the drain. Therefore, he's not going to be able to sell this soft power aspect of his personality. Therefore, we are presented with the plain fact that we are dealing with yet another smart but very harsh authoritarian leader in the Middle East.
Saudi Arabia has for many years had a horrible human rights record, and many issues have gone unresolved. This unique opportunity, given how much pressure Saudi is under, offers the world community a chance to really zero in on areas that need reform and to push Saudi Arabia to really truly modernize their society, including when it comes to human rights.
MBS has refused to take responsibility for the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi until now, and instead sacrificed his cronies, including his top aide, Saud al-Ghahtani. He now says he bears responsibility for the murder, as it happened under his watch.
What needs to be investigated is the extent to which the Crown Prince knew or should have known of what would have happened to Mr. Khashoggi, whether he directly or indirectly incited the killing, whether he acted without due diligence, whether he could have prevented the execution when the mission started and failed to do so. These are the range of issues which I believe a follow-up criminal investigation should focus on, along with the liability of other individuals. Over the year preceding the investigation, the execution of Mr. Khashoggi, a number of other human rights violations have been documented and have been denounced. There is no way the leaders of that state, including the Crown Prince, were not aware of those violations. In fact, there is evidence, credible evidence, pointing to their involvement.
MBS's lack of moral courage and fortitude, coupled with his poor judgment and leadership, means that he is now unlikely to succeed his father as king.
Keep in mind that we have a young crown prince. In the past years, he has committed a litany of, I would say, erratic decisions that began with the military campaign in Yemen. He waged a campaign in Yemen, a country where everybody knows that it is impossible to win it, to win its war. So he went to Yemen, he blockaded Qatar, he also apprehended more than 100 Saudi princes and business people, and of course he also ordered the arrest of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri. So this man has a track of committing irrational acts.
The ghost of Jamal Khashoggi is said to continue to haunt the House of Saud for years to come.